So the title of my paper, as you know, is Dressing Their Spiritual and Ecclesial Changes, Women Preachers in the Progressive Era. And just to clarify, Progressive Era dates are generally 1890 to 1920. So that's the time period that we'll be talking about this morning. At the time of her conversion, evangelist Amanda Berry Smith was deliberating over which spring outfit to purchase with the money she earned as a domestic servant working for a Quaker family. Finally, she decided. A white straw bonnet with a very pretty broad pink tie strings, pink or white muslin dress tucked to the waist, black silk mantilla, and light gaiter boots with black tips. I had it all picked out in my mind, my nice spring and summer suit. I can see the little box now where I had put all my money, saving up for this special purpose. Her dress dilemma coincided with an ongoing spiritual one. Specifically, her desire to be converted became entangled with buying or not the spring suit. She explained, "One day while I was praying, I got desperate, and here came my spring suit up constantly before me. So I told the Lord if he would take away the burden that was on my heart, that I would never get one of those things. I wouldn't get the bonnet, I wouldn't get the dress, I wouldn't get the mantilla, I wouldn't get the shoes. Oh, I wanted relief from the burden, and then all at once, there came a quiet peace in my heart, and that suit never came before me again." Smith did not end up purchasing the Au Courant outfit. Instead, she marked her spiritual transformation with a very different style patterned after the Quaker attire of her employer, known as plain dress. Historian Pamela Klassen describes plain dress as dress without unnecessary ornament made from solid drab fabric, usually in a uniform and figure obscuring style, and with a plain bonnet, usually white or black, worn close to the head. In her study of Quaker women's dress, Marianne Caton finds one characteristic in common, and that is the avoidance of certain features of high style worldly fashions and fads. The Quaker plain aesthetic was one of recognizable absence. By not buying the colorful spring suit and by changing into plain dress, Smith chose to display virtues of piety, simplicity, an aversion toward the material world, and a heightened interest in the spiritual world. Garbed in plain dress from bonnet to sturdy shoes, she went on to national and international fame across various networks, including speaking at Black and White Methodist churches, Wesleyan Holiness camp meetings, and WCTU, the Women's Christian Temperance Unit platforms. This study will demonstrate that women preachers in the progressive era changed dress to mark moments of a spiritual and ecclesial changes. Spiritual moments of transformation included conversion, as we just heard from Smith, who changed from fashionable into plain dress. The spiritual experience of sanctification also spurred on a dress change, as we will see for Mary Lee Cagle and Emma Ray. Then at ecclesial moments of change, women preachers like Mariah Woodworth Eder, Emma Ray, and Alma White quit mainline Methodism to join smaller, tightly knit Wesleyan Holiness churches. This dress change reflected their heightened adherence to holiness standards in order to differentiate themselves from the mainline churches following after middle-class respectability and fashion. In other words, women preachers changed dress to display spiritual and ecclesial change, to stem the tide of worldliness, and to mark the break with their former change, their former church. Dress change was more complicated for women than their male counterparts, because women preachers were on constant exhibit and heightened scrutiny in a public setting. What they wore had to negotiate and often mollify the hostility they faced. As historian Leah Payne explains, quote, "Most turn of the 20th century Americans took this historic position toward women pastors. There is in most of us," wrote the discontented man, don't you love that, the discontented man, in 1895, "there is in most of us," he wrote, "an inwardness of instinct against setting up a female in the prominence of the pulpit to lecture on their sins to a mixed congregation of men and women." What the author referred to, the Reverend Dr. Charles Parkhurst, who was senior minister of Madison Square Presbyterian Church in New York City, called andromania. Simply defined, Parkhurst, and he made up this word, defined andromania as, quote, "a passionate aping by women of everything that is masculine," unquote. In a full-page article in Ladies' Home Journal, also written in 1895, Parkhurst called andromania a disease with these symptoms. It is an attempt on the part of those affected with the disease to minimize distinctions by which manhood and womanhood are differentiated, whether as regards their culture, their interests, or their activities. It is that animus which accepts to having women's public activities along any line distinguished by any designation of sex, unquote. Women preachers, by the very nature of their activity of preaching in a public space, held the public gaze while speaking, a public in which many who attended believed they themselves suffered from such a disease. This situation then further compounded and quite honestly put a lot of pressure on the import of their dress and any change they made in that dress. So we're going to talk just a little bit about the importance of dress and how dressing signifies. Smith's dress change held momentous significance because dress signifies. It acts as a sign. Dress is a visible form of communication that conveys essential information about the wearer. As dress scholar Joanne Eicher writes, "Dress functions as a silent communication system that provides basic information about age, gender, marital status, occupation, religious affiliation, and ethnic background. Much information about identity is communicated through sensory cues provided by dress without the observer asking any questions," unquote. A significant piece of information communicated by Smith's dress was her gender. Another dress scholar, Gertrude Leonard, explains that the way people dress is among the most significant ways of doing gender. Doing gender means the conscious or unconscious staging of gendered selves in everyday life. Doing gender was even more critical when women dressed for the staging aspect of public speaking, particularly in this time period, when, as we have just been saying, great was the animosity toward women preachers. When any 19th century American woman ventured onto a public stage, clothing was a necessary and evocative medium for her message. And especially for religious trailblazers like women preachers, They had to look the part, but not veer off into too much masculinity, lest they be accused of andromania, or too much femininity in fashionable clothing, lest they not look sanctified or converted. Writing about sanctified women in the Church of God in Christ, the Kojic denomination, historian Anthea Butler's words apply to the women we will look at today as well. She writes, particularly for women, living the sanctified life meant that one's body and its public presentation was regulated from the tops of one head to the soles of one's feet. The outward appearance of both Kojic men and women was important, but the women bore the greater burden in keeping their bodies within the confines of sanctification, unquote. Because we're going to be talking about Methodists, I thought it was important to remind ourselves of what it meant to dress Methodists. So, plain dress, like what you see Sojourner Truth wearing in the slide, broadcasts the religious commitment of evangelical groups such as the Quakers and Methodists, who adopted Paul's admonition in 1 Timothy 2:9 as the primary biblical basis for plain dress, that the women should dress themselves modestly and decently in suitable clothing, not with their hair braided or with gold, pearls, or expensive clothes. This biblical teaching was fundamental for John Wesley, and he admonished his followers to dress accordingly. Wesley gave detailed instructions about dress for men, women, and children, mostly the don'ts, as in what not to wear. No gold, pearls, precious stones, fine linen, or costly apparel like silk or velvet. For women, no lace of any kind or color, no earrings, rings, necklaces, or ruffles. For men, no colored waistcoats, shining stockings, glittering or costly buckles or buttons. His admonition for plain dress made its way into early versions of the Methodist discipline published in the American colonies. To the question, should we insist on the rules concerning dress? The following answer was cited. By all means, this is no time to give encouragement to superfluity of apparel. Therefore, receive none into the church till they have left off superfluous ornaments. In order to do this, one, let everyone who has charge of a circuit or station read Mr. Wesley's thoughts upon dress at least once a year in every society. Two, in visiting the classes, be very mild but very strict. Three, allow of no exempt case, better one suffer than many. Four, give no tickets to any that wear high heads, enormous bonnets, ruffles, or rings, unquote. You feeling a little uncomfortable? An observer in 1831 differentiated Methodist dress from other mainline Protestants in these words. The Episcopalians showed most grandeur of dress and costume next to the Presbyterians, the gentlemen of whom freely indulged in powdered and frizzled hair. The Methodists desired to be a peculiar people, and for a time affected their purpose. The women all wore plain black satin bonnets. Straw bonnets were never seen among them. No white dresses, no jewelry, no rings. The females wore no curls, no side locks, or lace, or ornaments. Gradually, however, these admonitions waned and eventually disappeared altogether, as we will see in a moment. But for now, just to show you the contrast, we've been looking at plain dress. Now I want you to see what fashionable women were wearing at the time, just so you can visibly see what exactly is going on here. So we're going to talk about dressing fashionable women. The spring outfit Smith merely purchased exemplified fashionable dress in the late 19th century. During this age of conspicuous consumption, fashion became a more affordable commodity. Even the working class could purchase discretionary items. Mass production meant that clothes, souvenirs, newspapers, and more were affordable to almost everyone. Young female factory workers spent their meager wages on uncomfortable and impractical French heel shoes, inexpensive knockoffs of costly models. This meant that a domestic worker like Smith could keep pace with fashion, albeit at discounted prices. Women's dress style followed an A-line skirt, smooth and fitted around the hips, and slimmer in the front with gathers or pleats in the back. Sleeves grew larger, beginning with a tight sleeve on the upper arm and a puff set vertically high on the shoulder. Invisible to the public, women wore multiple layers and textures of underwear in order to achieve the well-upholstered look of a Victorian lady. Most women, even young girls, wore corsets to achieve the fashionable shape. It was an immensely complicated construction of either cotton or satin, composed of insets, gussets, and bands, some reinforced by whale bones with a straight steel busk in front and laces at the back. Ouch. The intricacy and intensity of women's dress, literally from head to toe, prompted this comment by Methodist Holiness preacher and evangelist Jenny Fowler Willing. God has not yet made the animal strong enough to endure what women are subjected to. Shut in close rooms, breathing exhausted air, with nothing to stir the blood, lungs compressed, heavy weights hung to the hips, everything heaped and pinned upon the head, and almost nothing on the feet. If they have even passable health, it is owing to a miracle of endurance. Fashionable dress also displayed strong colors. With the industrial age in full swing, the use of synthetic dyes, such as those made from aniline, developed from coal tar, allowed for brilliant, gorgeous hues in women's fashion. The crowning result? Women's clothes were as colorful as a parrot's plumage. Among them, shades of deep red, peacock blue, bright apple green, royal blue, purple mandarin, and sea green. Trimmings such as buttons, fringes, braids, puffs, and ribbons were displayed prominently, and they came in luscious materials like silk, satin, brocade, and velvet. Fashionably outfitted women wore jewelry and lots of it. According to Josiah Allen's wife, the writer Marietta Hawley, who was a Methodist writing at the turn of the century, who described one woman's jewelry in her customary colloquial language. She's describing a scene at the swanky Saratoga Springs resort. Why, one woman had so many diamonds on that she had a detective following her all around wherever she went. She was a blaze of splendor, and so was lots of them, though like the stars, they differed from each other in glory. Ellen Simpson, wife of Bishop Matthew Simpson, epitomized how a fashionable woman should dress. She was, after all, the wife of the leading Methodist in the United States, who entertained several American presidents in his home and was well known for his friendship with Abraham Lincoln. Her dress became the subject of an often told story about a well-to-do Presbyterian couple who hosted the Simpsons in their sumptuous, exquisitely appointed home. The Presbyterian hostess, who had a very sneering way of speaking of Methodists, thinking they were illiterate, plain people, anticipated that Mrs. Simpson would be wearing, quote, a well-worn bombazine, a linen collar, pinned by a common brass pin, hair twisted in a pigtail on the back of the head, a scoop bonnet, and cotton gloves. So the hostess chose to dress more simply in keeping with what she assumed a Methodist woman would wear. She twisted up her hair in a tight knot, took off her rings, wore a big flowered tycoon rep wrapper and a white apron, and thus appareled, took her stand in her parlor. Unfortunately for the hostess, Ellen Simpson dressed fashionably and elegantly. A rustling of silk was heard, and a tall, stately woman in black silk, ruffled to the waist after the fashion of that time, with expensive laces and jewelry, and with her hair done in the latest style, swept down the stairs and into the parlor. The Presbyterian woman concluded her sad tale with this observation, quote, "The Methodists of these days are up with the times," unquote. Dress became even more conspicuous against the backdrop of momentous foment in the religious landscape during the Progressive Era. Historian Ann Taves enumerates an ever-widening gulf in the late 19th century as that between religion of the church and religion of the camp meeting. Take the Methodist Episcopal Church North, for instance, which was then the largest denomination in the United States. At its centennial in 1884, Bishop Matthew Simpson assessed correctly that during its first century, Methodism had transitioned from frontier revivalism to liturgical services held in Gothic revival sanctuaries whose style was both splendid and expensive. This did not sit well with many folks in the pews. Fancy ideas, even in architecture, and the profound changes and shocks that accompanied them, observed William McLaughlin, registered most heavily upon those country-bred, evangelically-oriented individuals who made up the bulk of the nation's churchgoers. During the Progressive Era, this evangelical hegemony splintered markedly in reaction to seismic theological and economic shifts. And women preachers, among many thousands, left the mainline church at the height of its ascendancy in numbers, finances, and social and political prestige in order to unite with smaller holiness churches. Between 1880 and 1905, some 100,000 come-outers, as they were called, broke away from mainline Methodist churches to join holiness denominations, which maintained, they believed, the theological, social, and economic teachings spanning the centuries since John Wesley and the early Methodists. Many women preachers who left the mainline church to join or found their own religious institutions denounced Methodism's embrace of a middle-class lifestyle with its material prosperity, social standing, and cultural accommodation. In particular, they criticized mainline church members' worldly amusements and activities like fashionable dress, conspicuous consumption, elaborate ritual, expensive church buildings, and Sabbath breaking as behaviors which put one's soul in jeopardy. Dress became one sign to set them apart, especially as they stepped into church pulpits or onto camp meeting wooden stages to preach to a mixed audience of men and women. So let's look first at some specific examples of dressing spiritual change, along with Amanda Berry Smith, we've already seen. Excuse me, I'm gonna go to that in a minute. First of all, Mary Lee Cagle, a Church of the Nazarene evangelist, minister, and church planter, had a spiritual moment of reckoning when a holiness preacher spoke on the danger of worldly dress at her rural Arkansas Methodist church. For the first time, she noticed the gold, feathers, and flowers she was wearing. As the preacher continued on the topic, she realized that despite over 5 years of weekly attendance, she had never heard any reference to Methodism's general rules on dress. As she sat there that night while the man of God was preaching, she had on a hat with a rather high crown and some yellow chrysanthemums still higher than the crown. And as the preacher talked, it seemed to her that the flowers began to grow and finally then seemed a foot higher and were nodding back and forth and everyone was looking at them. Her conviction was so great that if she could have gotten the hat off and put it under the bench without anyone seeing it, she surely would have done so. When dressing for church the next morning, she hunted in the closet for her plainest dress. She did not curl her hair or powder her face and has never curled her hair since. Her mother's reaction to her dress change was surprise and disappointment, all wrapped up in her question, "Mary, are you going to church looking that way?" Mary was sanctified during that revival and ended up marrying the holiness preacher who preached on dress. Within a short time, they withdrew from the Methodist Church South and founded their own church, the New Testament Church of Christ, which eventually merged with the Nazarenes. Throughout her life, she maintained a fierce commitment to plain dress. She recalled being divinely prompted when she saw the fashionable dress at a camp meeting, a holiness camp meeting in Bebby, Arkansas. She recalled being divinely prompted to preach on dress. The sermon's finale covered the standard verses which she believed gave God's clear guidance on Christian dress, like 1 Peter 3:3, "Do not adorn yourselves outwardly by braiding your hair or by wearing gold ornaments or fine clothing." The 1 Timothy 2 passage I already read, and then from Exodus 33:4, "When the people heard these harsh words, they mourned, and no one put on ornaments." Afterwards, she recalled the people responded by stripping themselves of their ornaments, including a school teacher who removed her gold ring and gold clasp pin and arose shouting the praises of God. Next, we're going to look at Emma Ray, who's actually one of my favorites. I had the pleasure of learning about her and doing a lot of research on her when we lived in Seattle. I'm sorry, I promise you, I'm not doing this. It just seems to have a mind of its own. So sorry to be putting the slides back and forth. In a circa 1890 photo of the Francis Harper colored unit of the WCTU in Seattle, Washington, Emma Ray, who is the fourth from the left in the, actually, it's not the back row, it's the middle row. Fourth from the left or third from the right, is wearing a close-fitting dark-colored dress with small buttons and ribbon trim on the bodice. An oversized white lacy collar frames her neck. The 13 other women, all members of Jones Street African Methodist Episcopal Church, the AME Church, are similarly clad. 30 years later, in a photo of Emma and her husband, LP, on the frontispiece of her 1926 autobiography, as you see, her dress is strikingly altered. In place of the lacy collar, she wears a plain white shirt topped with a white clergy collar, and she changed from her close-fitting button bodice dress into a man's black suit jacket that is identical to her husband's. The only difference between them is his tie and her collar. Why the dress change? Like Kegel, Emma Ray was sanctified. She was initially introduced to sanctification from some white holiness folks who explained it through an illustrated chalk talk. They presented it as instantaneous following the shorter way playbook of preacher, author, and journal editor Phoebe Palmer, whom Mark Knoll refers to as, quote, "the major domo of the holiness movement," unquote. I love that phrase. From the moment she heard about it, Emma yearned to be sanctified, often pausing over the washtub while doing laundry to pray for it to happen. Finally, it did. And she writes, "It seemed that a strike of lightning had struck over the corner of the house, and it struck me on the top of the head and went through my body from head to foot like liquid fire. As my strength began to return, I felt a passion, such a love for souls as I had never felt before. I saw a lost world, my heart became hot, a fire of holy, abiding love for God and souls was kindled at that hour, and I feel it will last until Jesus comes." To mark her sanctification, she changed dress. Women preachers also changed dress to mark their ecclesial change. Let's look first at Mariah Woodworth Eder, who preached and planted churches for 2 decades for the Churches of God Weinbrenner, an offshoot from Methodism, before she moved into Pentecostal circles. Woodworth Eder disparaged her former church with unflattering adjectives and phrases such as dead, very weak, contentious, few in working order, valley of dry bones, and worldly. She labeled the mainline church as having lost its power. She writes, "Oh, the spiritual death that has come over the churches in this part of the country. They have drifted into formality and gone out after the world," she complained. Early in her preaching, she held many meetings in Methodist churches, which she did on purpose, particularly if no evangelist had succeeded there previously, because she wanted to be the change agent to revive this mainline church with an influx of energetic, spiritually alive members. This happened at the Methodist Church in Pleasant Mills, Indiana. She writes, "I could only find 6 who had any experience. They were the discouraged. Even the minister had no hope of it being built up again. A good many of the brethren advised me not to go, but I thought if it was such a hard place, work was needed there worse than anywhere else." As a result of her meetings, new members joined the Methodist Church. The same thing happened at the Methodist Church in Van Wert, Ohio, which was forsaken looking, surrounded by weeds several feet high, and ready for the real estate market. Not only did it blossom with her converts, but also the increase in attendance secured the appointment of a new minister. When she preached, as you see, she wore a plain ensemble that portrayed her in a matronly, modest manner. Leah Payne describes her preaching attire as, quote, "a simplified, desexualized version of turn-of-the-century styles." Her unofficial uniform was a plain white dress and a modest, full-length, usually black coat. While her more fashionable counterparts, as we've seen, wore S corsets to display their womanly form, her loose-fitting dresses de-emphasized her waist and bust. The sleeves were minimally puffed. Her most flamboyant accessories were a chaste black bonnet and thin white gloves. This dress played strategically to present her as being free from fashion and world vanities and fully committed without equivocation to preaching the gospel. Back to Emma Ray, when Emma and L.P. Ray spoke about sanctification in their AME church in Seattle, Washington, their minister censored them. So eventually they left the mainline AME and joined the Free Methodist Church. Joining this holiness church prompted Emma to change her hairstyle. We've been looking at dress, but hair is also a part of the dress. For 30 years, from age 11, where you see her in a rare photograph, she's obviously a nanny to a young white girl. For 30 years, from age 11 to her early 40s, she wore false hair in what was called a chignon or a waterfall. You can see it there in this picture. She described it as a great big amount of hair with wires run through to hold it on and make it light and puffy. Her attention to hair reflected an essential aspect of fashionable dress, because even the head warranted dressing up and became the site for a complicated and compelling coiffure with braids, chignons, and loops of a woman's own carefully arranged hair or of false hair. But Emma became convicted that her stylish hair was an expression of vanity separating her from God. So in order to maintain her sanctification, it had to be removed. I had worn it so long that it had killed the roots of my hair, and I was partially bald, and I would not listen to any suggestions about putting it away. It took me a long time to get my hair all fixed and curled. I had to dye it to keep it black. I spent many dollars upon invisible pins and nets, besides a whole lot of worry as to whether I had it on straight or not. I did not want anyone to know I wore it, and many times I was late getting to church Sunday morning because I would stand before the glass to see if I had it good and secure, and I often tried my husband by taking so much time. I began to get tired of it, and I would do it up Saturday nights all ready for the Sabbath, but somehow I could not fix it right. Feeling a divine directive to remove the false hair with its accoutrements, she took it off and threw it into the fire. Her story ended with these words. I took my comb and brush and brushed what little hair I had. I made me a little bonnet and put streamers of ribbon and tied them under my chin. The ribbons covered the bald places on the back of my head where the hairpins had worn the hair off. That night, my sleep was so peaceful. Her unadorned hair, along with her dress change, signaled both her spiritual and ecclesial changes. She dressed as did her Free Methodist counterparts, as we see in this photo taken in the early 1920s at a Snohomish camp meeting just north of the city. And if you can see, she is seated in the middle of the women. She is the only Black woman, and right behind her is standing LP, who was mulatto. I hope this is fun for you, by the way. I have had such fun learning about clothing. So maybe because I was a seamstress and when I was a young girl, so I hope it's been fun for you. We're gonna look at our last woman before the conclusion, and that is the indomitable Alma White. Alma White married a Methodist minister and preached in Methodist pulpits in Colorado until she encountered opposition both to women preachers and to the doctrine of sanctification. She quit Methodism to start a new holiness church, the Pillar of Fire. She too belittled her former church, declaring that whereas God had in former times raised it up as the true church, now its holy zeal had dwindled and it no longer held the apple of God's eye. Using a boat metaphor, she described Methodism as, quote, an old painted hulk with no power, no fire, and no steam, simply a towed-in vessel that will never plow the billows of the story deep again, unquote. To separate her church visibly from the mainline church, White adopted a uniform for Pillar of Fire workers to wear, particularly when they were out and about on church business. She believed that the uniform would solidify church members into a phalanx, like an army. She writes, "The Pillar of Fire in uniform is like an army." And she went on to speak of the uniform as dressing up a militant church warring against worldliness. It certainly did broadcast the church's religious work, what sociologist Nathan Joseph would later refer to as, quote, witnessing by wearing the uniform, unquote. She decreed that everyone who joined the Pillar of Fire had to signal this ecclesial change by discarding their previous dress and putting on the uniform. Uniforms came in dark colors, with black being the most consistent choice. The material used most often was serge, a strong twill fabric with a pronounced diagonal rib on the front and the back. Surge was chosen because it met the twin criteria of being economical and durable. The women's uniform consisted of a sailor blouse with very full sleeves and a five-gored skirt gathered around the waist in dark navy serge. It was trimmed with deep pockets and round collars. Topping the uniform was the hat, which sparked a great debate. After an unsuccessful search through milliner shops, the women designed their own. They fashioned a short-backed sailor by using very lightweight serge drawn over a cardboard base for the brim. A small scarf was draped around the crown, and the ties of navy ribbon fastened at the back of the hat were tied in a small bow under the chin. Church seamstresses kept the members in uniform, alternating lightweight or heavier material depending on the season. I had the pleasure of interviewing some longtime members when I went to Zarephath, New Jersey, where Alma White's church and really her town was founded. And one of them, in her reminiscences about the uniform's unflattering cut, joked that, quote, Omar the tent maker made them. To make them more fashionable, she explained, we learned how to make a seam for a princess waistline. The uniform replaced every aspect of women's fashionable dress that Alma White disdained. She put to verse her critique of fashionable dress and published it in her magazine, Woman's Chains. I'll warn you that the poem is not sophisticated. The skirts are short, the necks are low, you'll see it everywhere you go. No matter what a woman thinks of fashion's bold from which she shrinks. She must the latest togs all wear, must paint her face and bob her hair, so that a market may be had for every vain and foolish fad. Her neck and arms they would have bare, a place for jewels rich and rare. And thus you see that woman's made the dupe of all the tricks of trade. The pillar of fire uniform not only covered women's bodies fully and appropriately, but also signified their ecclesial change and religious purpose, and I would say was also a critique of women's fashions. So just a very brief conclusion. I presented how women preachers in the progressive era changed dress to mark spiritual transformations like Smith's change from fashionable to plain dress, like Mary Lee Cagle's eliminating gold and jewelry and fancy bits to mark her sanctification, and Emma Ray's changing from her fashionable dress actually to what male preachers would have worn. And women preachers also changed dress when they made an ecclesial change, like we've seen with Mariah Woodworth Eder, Mary Lee Cagle, Emma Ray, and Alma White. And this change coincided with the mainline church's rise in stature, in social class architecture, and in dress. In contrast, women preachers' fossilized fashion was staged to mark a visible contrast with what they considered to be the mainline church's excesses. Dressing their spiritual and ecclesial changes continued on display by women preachers on the cusp of the progressive era. Highly touted child evangelist Uldine Utley, who was converted in 1921 at age 9 during an evangelistic meeting preached by Amy Semple McPherson, also changed dress. She started wearing her trademark white upon white dress, all white from shoes to collar. Such dress, as we've seen, marked transformative moments like Uldine Utley's conversion. When she was 14, she stood poised on the mammoth stage of Madison Square Garden in New York City before a vast sea of 14,000 strangers in 1926. This was Uldine's four-week, two-sermons-a-day evangelistic campaign in the city, where the vast crowds had responded enthusiastically to the diminutive, blue-eyed, fair-haired evangelist, outfitted in her customary white robe, hose, and shoes, with a bulky leather-bound Bible held high in her petite right hand. Her preaching dress, like the other women preachers we've considered this morning, helped her stage the setting in order to inculcate the public's positive gaze. Thank you.